Okay, welcome to week four. Of course, before we start, yesterday was a Jewish sad day, I think it's fast to say, for the whole world. I want to, you know, in the Jewish tradition, we always have a way of responding to different things. So I want to, one of them is to learn in the memory of people's souls. So I want to dedicate today's shiur to the Bibas Kedoshim, those holy ones that have given up the neshama.
Rabbi,
yes?
I feel that we need to go to either Waverly or Bilara Council and ask for a street in our area to be named after them.
Yeah.
Okay. It's done in other countries.
I can't see
why Australia, where you know, there's so much of anti-Semitism that we don't have. So I don't know.
All these are good. Yeah, sure, no, I understand. Of course, but I agree that I'm certainly in the area of these kind of things. It's not my area of expertise at all. But what we can do is certainly we can definitely learn, and learning draws down blessing, and we can certainly do it in the memory of their neshamas, their souls. So just to review a little bit from last week. There's one down here. So can someone pass a handout up? So.
Hey,
Daisy there.
Thank you.
Yes, all good. Okay, so last week we talked about worry. How bad worry, of course, is ineffective, paralyzing, consuming. And we talked about the difference between good and bad worry. Good worry, of course, leads to action. Bad worry is something that we worry about that we cannot control. And we went into the various strategies, like using the original strategy of distracting ourselves from negative thoughts, also reflecting on the uncertainty of the future. We worry about things we don't even know what's going to be. Anything can change, as we do know, as we see in the world so strongly today. So no point in worrying about things, about a future that we don't even know what the future is going to look like. But the main thing we discussed last week is we revisited very strongly the concept of bitachon, taken from the works of the Chovat HaLevavot from the 11th century, who wrote a whole thesis on bitachon, essentially based on three principles. God runs the world. Secondly, he is the ultimate source of good, even though we don't always understand it. He loves and he cares for us, and we are in his hands. Which those three things are the aim of bitachon. You know, bitachon is working when it creates a sense of calm and a sense of certainty. The tension is, of course, is that we spoke about last week, the necessity to invest our own efforts as well. That's what God wants us to do. We refer to that as hishtadlut, and that's where the two sort of, we need to know how to balance those two things. And the obvious other difficulty with bitachon, it really requires a very strong sense of letting go, and us human beings, especially when we perceive that our efforts make such a difference, we find it very difficult to let go, but that's part of what bitachon is. Then we talk about the idea of just positive thinking. Positive thinking itself is what brings down the blessing. The tension and the balance between emunah and bitachon. Emunah is sometimes hard to have bitachon because we see, and to really be sure and certain and confident things will turn out because we have seen things not be so good, right? But that's the Jewish way. We're able to come to hold these opposites, that we accept and have emunah and faith for things that have happened, but yet we focus on the good and we're positive about things going forward. So that's a difficult thing to do. Okay. That's just a quick review of last week's session. Now, today, we're going to talk about, in the daily struggles issue, area, space, we're going to talk about two topics, which are linked, really. First topic is bad moods. Anyone have bad moods? And the second is self-criticism. So, look, I think it's probably true that, let's talk about the first topic first, it's probably true that some are more moody than others, but I think it's fair to say that all of us kind of fluctuate a bit. We sometimes up, sometimes not up, sometimes down, sometimes happy, sometimes more reflective. And we have good moods and bad moods, right? And it's difficult sometimes because I suppose not only this fluctuation and swing of moods affect ourselves, they also affect the people we have a relationship with. Right? It's not easy to navigate the unpredictability of people that we live with. So moods obviously happen for various reasons. They happen from sometimes from external reasons, But sometimes just unprompted, sometimes just on a low, you know. So I want to just explore, it's not a very long topic, that's why I put two topics today. But I want to just explore some of the strategies. But before we do that, in order to understand some of the strategies, we also have to understand philosophically a little bit the origin of mood swings, the origin of why we fluctuate into different types of moods. Because once we do that and we understand, we'll be able to understand that swing of moods or fluctuation of moods are actually not that terrible. Meaning the source of them is not evil, it's not toxic. It might actually come from a positive thing. We just need to know how to manage it and how to navigate it and how to channel it maybe. So in order to do this, I just need to give you a little bit of a crash course on Kabbalah. Is that okay? A concept in Kabbalah. So there's a midrash which is explained by the Arizal, Kabbalistically. The midrash says that it was a teaching of a rabbi called Rab Avahu. This is like 3rd, 4th century stuff. And he said that when God created the world, he built worlds that he didn't like and then he destroyed them until he built the current world. And he said about the world now, this pleases me and the other worlds didn't please me. Which of course is very cryptic because that's very common. That's very common with a human being. You know, we have a few goes at something and the first one didn't work and doesn't look well, then we chuck it out, we try again. Okay, that's a kind of a normal human experience. But certainly with God, if he has a plan to build a world, to create a world, surely he knows what he's doing. Surely he knows what he wants to do, he knows what the outcome will be, and he'll get it right the first time, right? So what does this mean? And all kinds of different interpretations until we have the interpretation of the Arizal. The Arizal was, I don't know if anyone's familiar with Arizal, Arizal was an unbelievable Kabbalist, an amazing, amazing person. He lived in Tzfat. Wasn't born in Tzfat, he came from Egypt, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And then he moved to Tzfat. He wasn't in Tzfat for very long and he didn't live very long. He lived only into his 30s. But he lived in Tzfat, and in the time he lived in Tzfat, he had an amazing impact on the teachings of the Kabbalah. He's probably credited with the movement of the genesis of the movement of the dissemination of mysticism, esoteric part of Torah, and secrets of Torah. Eventually it evolved into the Hasidic movement, which is based on Kabbalah in a large part, and so on. So he was a turning point in Jewish history. And he explained this midrash in the following way. And it's based on a concept we learn in Kabbalah called Tohu and Tikkun. Tohu and Tikkun means the following. Tohu means chaos, Tikkun means order. That it's what Rabbi Avahu meant when God first created the world. We know that we've talked about many times that God created a world with a formula. And the formula was the 10 powers, the 10 sfirot, right? Particularly the emotional ones, particularly the 7 ones of Chesed, Gevurah, and Tiferet, right? And even though our world is governed by those 10 powers, and particularly by those 7 emotions, which is why the week God created the world in 6 days, and then the 7th day Shabbat, which is Malchut, and so on. There are many worlds that are also governed. We're not the only world. There are upper worlds, there are spiritual worlds. But Rabbi Avahu says that the Midrash tells us that before God created the chain of spiritual worlds that we have now, he first created the world of Tohu, the world of chaos. Why is it the world of chaos? Because when he first revealed this idea of these 10 powers, he revealed them that each one in their own way was very strong and inflexible and not able to integrate with others. So in other words, Chesed was pure Chesed, Chesed in the extreme. Gevura was pure Gevura, and there was no interaction or interplay between the Sfirot, right? God did that intentionally. And the reason for that is because obviously when you develop emotions, they first have to be developed, each one in their own right, and be highlighted for what they are in their purity and in their extreme. The problem with that, of course, is that world is headed for destruction. Of course, for existence to be, you need combination, you need balance, you need symphony, you need interaction between the different midot between the different sefirot, the different characters, right? Where you see this today in real life is with a child. Just so you understand how this works, right? A child is a very chaotic existence. Part of the reason is because most children do not live with different emotions coming together. You realize that, right? When a child is unhappy, the world has come to an end. Tomorrow the world might be a wonderful, beautiful, blissful place. But right now the world is terrible, right? There's no nuance. No nuance whatsoever. And it's by design, because a child is developed, and they develop their emotions, they develop their character, they develop their consciousness, and it needs to be developed strongly. Each thing has to be developed properly for its, in its own right before it interact with something else. So that is why it's there, and that's why the child passion. And in fact, some of that is very strong and very passionate, and some of it we have to learn, even as adults, how to incorporate that within our own existence and our own experience. But that concept itself, that concept of tohu, creates chaos, because when there's no interaction, it cannot exist. And therefore, ultimately, the Kabbalah has this concept where what happened with that world, so to speak, the world of the 10, spiritual world, of course, what happened with the 10 sefirot, the 10 powers, which were created in a way of each one in their own without any ability to interact and to be nuancely combined with the others, there was something we call Shvirat HaKelim. The vessels exploded. It's a world that exploded. And according to Kabbalah, we have in our world sparks of that world which we have to connect to and elevate, which is for another time. Okay, but that's the world of Tov. So what did God do? And this was all part of the design. It wasn't like he made a mistake that he created a world he didn't like. Then once that was there, he then created the 10 powers, or expressed the 10 powers, or revealed the 10 powers in a way of tikkun, a way of order. Order means where there's an existence that's governed by these 10 powers, but there's an existence where those 10 powers can tolerate each other, and they can interact with each other, and they can be share common ground with each other, and there can be overlap and gray areas and balanced areas and so on and so forth. Yeah, is that synopsis? Okay. However, although the world of chaos has some opportunity to it, like we say, it's very strong and it's like a childlike passion, but the point of existence and the ultimate goal of existence is to exist within the world of tikkun, the world of order. However, in this world of order, which is the only way the world could exist, as we said, there is overlap. There's overlap between the various emotions. And that actually, Kabbalistically, is the source of our mood changes. Because we're not binary that way. We're not in terms of our personality, right? Because it's overlap, we sometimes like this, sometimes like that, sometimes in the middle. And that's actually where the mood comes from, which you can already see. What we do about it, we'll see in a second. But we can already see it's actually not coming from a bad thing. It's coming because we live in the world of order, actually. And the world of order can only be when there's overlap and interplay between the different character traits. But also what it brings is a change of feeling. Again, we're talking about 7 emotions, right? The main part of our experience comes from the 7 emotions. Emotions are very strong. And when there's overlap and interplay between the emotions, it can affect our personality. And sometimes the chesed shows up more, sometimes the gevura shows up more, sometimes somewhere in the middle shows up more, whatever the case is, which actually affects the way we think and we feel particularly. So I want to tell you a story about the Babacher Rebbe's response to one of these things. And this is a story about a rabbi who lives today in Israel, quite a famous rabbi in the Chabad movement. His name is Rabbi Zalman Gopin. He was originally Russian, his family and him lived under Russian oppression. Eventually they escaped. And he was a very serious boy and took his studies very, very seriously. They emigrated to Israel. And he was very involved in the study of Hasidic philosophy and general studies and so on. And when he was 20 years old, he came from Israel, eventually went back to Israel, but he came from Israel to learn and to study under the Rebbe's tutelage. This was in 1965. And to be with him and study his teachings and to seek his counsel and so on and so forth. At that time, it was common that the students in the Chabad Yeshiva would, once a year at least, or sometimes for other reasons, more often maybe, they were granted a private audience with the Rebbe. And And when they would have that, they would, the way it would used to work, they used to write. And the way, just I'll tell you, the private audience system was, you didn't actually go in and talk, you went in and wrote down what you want, and then the Rebbe would read it, and then the Rebbe would talk to you, or ask you questions, or bless you, whatever. So he went in and he wrote the following note to the Rebbe, and he said to him that he has a problem that he's very prone to mood swings. That's what he wrote to the Rebbe. And he said, sometimes I get on a good streak for a while, but it doesn't always last because my mood changes and then it disrupts it and I just feel like it's high and low and it doesn't work. So I'm asking him what to do about it. So because the Rebbe was aware of him and he was aware of his learning and his study, he told him, he responded to him Kabbalistically. That's why I gave this introduction. He responded to him Kabbalistically and he told him that actually the source of mood swings is from this concept. Because we live in the world of tikkun, in the world of order, where the emotions interplay with each other and overlap with each other, that's why it happens, right? He told him the following. He said that when we live in that world, the Rebbe said in Yiddish, and he made with his hand, he said, Amol azoy and Amol azoy. Sometimes like this and sometimes like that, he said, right? And what he said to him and what he said to other people, he said, people are not static. And this is the greatness of the human being. That we're not static. We are flexible. Because we are flexible, that's why we get into different moods sometimes, right? And he quoted a verse from the Tanakh, Sheva Yipol Tzadik V'kam, that even a righteous person fails. The fail doesn't mean only makes a mistake. Fail can mean even within himself. We have highs and we have lows. That's the way the human being is, right? He wrote a different letter. He wrote that every person is a changing being and therefore also experiences changes in their state of mind. However, it should not be perceived too severely, because your change of unpleasant state of mind is only a transient phenomenon, right? And because we're multifaceted and because we are go from one to each other, the Rebbe said the following. This is the advice he gave him. So first of all, he told him it's normal. It's actually an outcome of the greatness of this world. It's an outcome of the opportunity to grow because we can move from one into another. In other words, our abilities are weakness. In other words, the ability that we have not to be defined by one emotion, not to be defined by one perspective, not to be defined by one approach, that ability also brings sometimes those difficulties of navigating mood swings, right? So he told him the following. What you need to do, therefore, is the following. It's a very interesting perspective because we see from this that these low mood swings or high mood swings are not toxic. They just need to be channeled. They are toxic if you leave them, but he says, you have to understand, he says, there's different things, he said to Rabbi Gopin, who was a student, and this could be applied in different experiences to different people. He says that when you are in a lower mood, you need to understand that's coming from less chesed and more gevurah, I imagine. And therefore, what it actually is at its essence, it means that you can be more reflective. So he says, when you're going through that, you should use it to immerse yourself in deep reflective study. Told him he should. That's a time he's got to just focus on his learning in a very deep way, reflective way, analytical way, right? But he says, and then when your mood changes more to an uplifting way, then he says, you know, that's an opportunity and a call to study a bit differently. Then you've got to study with a broadness of mind, like look up other things, compare to, in other words, be more flexible. In other words, he was telling him like this, let's take, because he was talking about study, because that's what he was talking to him about, right? Because he was a student in yeshiva. He's saying the different modes of study. Sometimes we study in a more reflective way, where we're trying to understand more deeply what it says. Sometimes we study in a more broad way, where we're comparing it to other things, where we're looking up other perspectives, we're looking up other sources, comparing them, contrasting them. He says that would come from a better mood. So he says, depends what your mood is, that's how you know you have to study at that time. And then he says also, when you're in a more uplifting mood, which is a more chesed mood, then you know that's a call of an hour, try and go do things for other people. That would be a great time to channel that into helping others. Now that doesn't mean that on those different perspectives of study or systems of study or kindness to others is restricted to your mood. God forbid, that doesn't mean that at all. Because sometimes we just got to do what we got to do. We might be in a bad mood, but we've got to still help others, right? Or we might need to reflect on something even if we're in a better mood. But the point he was trying to make is that it's It's mood swings. It's an amazing perspective that mood swings or mood changes are not coming from a toxic place. It's not like hatred or anger that we spoke about in a number of weeks, right? This actually is coming from the essence of how the human being works. We're just transient. We're flexible. We're not rigid people. We don't belong to the world of Tohu. We belong to the world of Tikkun. And therefore, we have to know just how to channel it. And to understand, when you understand it's not so bad, you're not so drawn down by it, right? And you're able to channel it. See, well, I'm that kind of mood. How can I use it for the good? And that might be different for every type of person. And of course, another point with this mood thing is, again, sometimes bad moods come from external things. And he doesn't mention this phrase, but you know, there's a phrase in Hebrew that helps people get through a lot of difficulty and challenging, and that is a phrase called Gam Ze Yavor. It will pass, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes we don't think, sometimes we fall into a trap. It could be with anything, not only mood swings. Sometimes we fall into a bit of a challenging time, and you know, it's like the end of the world, right? And then sometimes, I don't know if you had this experience, but often you look back a couple of years later and you think like, Musa, what was so bad? Like, okay, it happened, it's passed, it's fine, right? So the mood swings, that's particularly true. It's a separate point, not the same point as before. But, you know, sometimes it comes, people are unsettled, and therefore sometimes they go through difficulty. When we move, when we have a change of relationship, when we, you know, we go through things, it's difficult. We come to a new place, especially for younger people. It can be very challenging, and sometimes that affects how we are. That's external things. There, the Rebbe writes that the strategy really is just to reflect on, you know, do stuff to settle, do stuff to make the best of it, but no, it's going to pass. Like, you're going to get used to it. It's going to pass by, and it was okay. I remember once with me, we had my daughter who just had a baby recently. She, when we, for whatever reason, there was a whole host of reasons, but when she was in year 11, we actually sent her away. It was the only one of our daughters we did that with, but it was better for her to go overseas and finish school. It was a very good class over there, and it was a very good school, and to finish school there. And she was very motivated to do that, otherwise I wouldn't have considered it. And she wanted to do it. Okay, so I took her there, actually traveled with her, and then enrolled in the school, and we settled down, and I left, obviously, and I knew it would be difficult, right? And for the first couple of weeks, I used to get these texts, I'm so homesick. And my kishkes used to go crazy, right? I think to myself, no, you got to give it a little bit of time, right? So I kind of used this method. So we spoke a lot and every day, but it was just, you know, it was hard. It was just a new place. She was a bit reserved. She wasn't making new friends that quickly. Then she made amazing friends. And eventually, after like 1 or 2 weeks, I told her, listen, I'm not going to leave you there if you're going to feel that way, obviously. But can we just give it like another 3 weeks? I don't know what it was, 2.5. I gave her a deadline. I said, if you're still feeling that way, coming home. A week and a half later, nah, I'm not coming home. I'm fine. I'm good. Everything's fine. Right? There are things that put us in the challenges that just take time. And that's an important thing also to know. Sometimes that we are in a lower mood and it just has to do with things that have been happening, and Gam Ze Yavor, it will pass. Obviously, we're going to do something about it in the meantime and put in effort that the situation that we're in should improve, but it will pass and it will come away. Okay. Could you get some air for a few minutes? Thank you so much. We've got a new role there. That's a... All right. This leads a bit into the next topic. But why I say it's linked, because sometimes our mood swings come from this. But it's a general issue, and it's an issue of self-criticism. Right? Self-criticism, where people, not everyone, some people never criticize themselves, which is a separate problem, which we'll talk about soon. Right? What's that? No, it is. I mean, we've got to be self-aware, right? None of us are perfect, I promise you, right? So a bit of self-analysis is not such a bad thing sometimes, which we'll talk about soon. But a lot of us often put ourselves down, right? I'm lazy, I'm selfish, I'm a bad person, I'm a bad parent, I'm a bad spouse, I'm a bad this, I'm a bad that. So it's not a good thing. Generally, self-criticism is not a good thing. We will explore in a minute the difference between self-criticism and a healthy self-awareness. But before we understand, I want to give a bit of context to this and share with you not a Kabbalistic concept, but a halachic concept, a legal concept. And I'm not a historian in law or anything like that, but this is what I believe, what I've read. that in medieval times, in a court system and a justice system, confession was enough to convict someone. Right? Someone walked into a court, said, I did this, that was it. Right? Apparently, beginning in the 1600s, when the sort of more Western legal system was more in force, they adopted a new idea. It's called something which I can't pronounce. It's in Latin, but it's translated as the body of the crime, which means apparently that they said that you can't only have confession. Confession alone is not enough. You need to have some sort of evidence that the crime actually took place. There has to be some evidence of the crime, right? However, even then, even today, confession plays a major role sometimes. In fact, there's a lot that has, I don't know if you know, there's like a whole innocence project, particularly in America, that happens today, of freeing people when they know the crime didn't happen, even with people that confess to a crime. Because sometimes people can confess falsely, they confess under duress, and now with the introduction of DNA, they've actually gone back and unturned a lot of different crimes it's quite an amazing thing. If you ever watch videos, and it's quite an amazing thing, where they go back to the crime scene, they retrieve DNA, and it's just the crime couldn't have happened because the DNA evidence is just not there, right? Even though the person confessed. Why am I bringing this in? Because Jewish law is actually quite non-accepting of confession. Very interesting thing. In a Jewish court of law, even in ancient times when, you know, there were fines imposed and punishments imposed and even capital punishment, and on the rare occasion imposed and things like that, a person could be never convicted by a confession. That's how it works. Never. Meaning, a person has their own moral obligation. So if a person stole something and they rock up to a court of law and says, listen, I'm turning myself in because I stole something, of course the court will instruct him, well, you need to give it back. That's obvious, right? Because giving it back is not a punishment. If you stole something, we don't know if you did or not, but if you did, there's a mitzvah to return it. So that's what you better do. But even in such a case, in Jewish law, for example, there are fines. Not enforceable today because we don't have that kind of Jewish court, but there are fines that can be imposed upon a person that stole, for example. There's something called kefil. There were times in Jewish history when a Jewish law was in force, where if a person there was testimony that a person stole, they would have to repay not just the value of the thing that they stole, but they'd have to pay double. It's a Torah fine, right? That fine is above the basic obligation of returning what you stole. It's a fine, it's an imposed fine from a court. The court cannot, the Bet Din cannot enforce that with confession. Very interesting thing. Why? So, there was a great Talmudist who, it's actually based on two principles. Two principles in the Talmud. One principle is, Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rasha. A person cannot describe themselves as evil. You cannot be believed. I cannot believe you if you tell me that you did something terribly wrong. In a legal sense. Why not? So another one of the great Talmudists, name was Rava, he said that Adam Karov Eitzel Atzmo. A person is related to themselves. You're related to themselves. What does it mean? You're a relative of yourself, right? What does that mean? We know that relatives in Jewish law are not accepted as witnesses. Do you know that? At all. Ever. A relative can't be a witness. Even, by the way, if it's not for conviction purposes, like today, if you have a wedding, for example, and a wedding, we need two kosher witnesses to witness the giving of the ring, for example, in order for the wedding to be valid. Those two witnesses cannot be related to each other. They cannot be related to the groom. They cannot be related to the bride. And it goes quite. Even a second cousin is no good. I mean, after it stops after a while. It's very complex laws. I actually just, this is nothing to the topic, but it's a fascinating thing. I was once, there was a guest rabbi here, very very good, very famous guest, a competent guest rabbi, and the Beit Din here was doing a conversion. And for conversion, you need three judges, right? Now there was the main, it was Rabbi Ullman at the time, and he was doing a conversion, and he needs three people with him, and there were people missing that day. Anyway, so he took the guest rabbi with him, and also myself. I was there as well, and we We oversaw the conversion. Yes, questions, you got the whole thing, the mikveh, the acceptance of the mitzvot, and so on and so forth. In the car backwards, this guest rabbi suddenly realized he's a second cousin by marriage of one of the judges. But yeah, even if a second cousin of marriage, also not good, yeah. Right? So he had to, they had to bring the person back and redo it, unfortunately. I mean, it was an innocent mistake. Right? It's happened sometimes on a ketubah, on a wedding, that people don't, sometimes a second cousin, you don't realize, you know, you forget. If it's a sister, brother, it's obvious, but this was like a second cousin, so anyway, they had to do it again. But it doesn't, normally you clarify these things, but it can happen. So, but any type of, every type of testimony, any type of sort of giving edut cannot happen with a relative. Why? Because part of the reason is because a relative has bias. And by the way, the bias isn't only in favor of the person, sometimes the bias is against the person. You know, relatives fight more than other people sometimes, right? You know, can you imagine you call a guy to testify about his mother-in-law, right? That's not a good idea, because even though he's going to say, I'm not biased. Yeah, but it could be he's biased the other way, right? I'm just kidding. Okay, but so it's a problem. So what's that relative? Why am I using that? Because it's being used for people being dishonest with themselves in terms of their own self-analysis. It is sometimes very bad to testify about yourself, even to yourself, right? To define yourself, to describe yourself, to put yourself down, or to overinflate yourself for that matter, right? Because you're not objective, you're subjective. And therefore, when people put themselves down and they come and tell themselves that, you know, they're bad and they're this and they're that, and I'm a terrible parent, I'm a terrible friend, I'm a terrible this, I'm a terrible that, Adam Karov Eitzel Atzmo, you are related to yourself. We can't accept that testimony, right? This phrase, of course, is meant legalistic, in a legal way, but in a legalistic way, but it extends, it extrapolates to this concept, this emotional idea, and the spiritual sort of testimony as well. Now, we have to break this down a little bit. Why? Because we also have the concept in Judaism, very, very strongly, of cheshbon ha-nefesh, right? I mean, you've heard me talk about it every time Elul comes, every time the month of Elul comes, right? We talk about being self-reflective and reflecting and making an honest stock take of what we've done in the previous year. So how does that fit with this, right? How does that fit with not becoming a harsh critic of ourselves? And we do, as I said before, we do encourage people to be self-aware, right? Because on the flip side of harsh criticism or harsh self-criticism, the flip side of that is a completely lack of self-awareness, which you've all met people, I'm sure, that have that problem, right? And sometimes that lack of self-awareness is really a source of anguish and a lack of growth and pain to others, right? Doesn't happen now, but many, many years ago when we davened here, I mean, there were certain people who always used to push themselves to lead the services because they talked themselves into it that they're a good chazan. And they were shocking, right? And they always found the one person that liked it. Okay, but I mean, most people didn't like it, right? Or you have teachers sometimes, unfortunately, that can go year after year in a classroom and it's not working. Like, it's not working, give it up. But some people are just not self-aware or blaming others or whatever the case is, right? So it's and you know, self-reflection is a good thing. Someone gives a shiur, someone gives a speech, it's good to self-reflect. Did it go well? Didn't it go well? Did people listen? Not listen? Right? I mean, we don't always get it right, but self-awareness is a good thing. So there are a number of ways to combine those two ideas. In other words, this that we say you can't be a harsh critic of yourself because it's unhealthy, right? Together with the need to be self-aware and to reflect and to improve. That's the whole idea. We always talk about in the month of Elul, you have to be self-aware, you have to make a cheshbon, a calculation. Then you have to highlight the things that are areas of weakness. Then you have to feel uncomfortable about them. Then you have to resolve, you have to regret them and resolve to become better. So how does that work? But then it starts off with my self-evaluation, but we're saying that's not always true, right? So there are a couple of things we need to know. There's a beautiful little book called Hayom Yom, Day to Day. I read it every single day. It's a short thing every day. It was made in 1943. The Yilbavitcher Rebbe, who wasn't the Rebbe yet, he was working with his father-in-law, who was the previous Rebbe. He put together like a calendar, a 1943 calendar, a Jewish calendar, that was had all the calendar stuff in it, but every day it had a saying, or a little paragraph, or a story, or something from the letters of his father, or the letters of the previous Rebbe. And there's some beautiful, sometimes a bit harder to understand, a bit more technical, but sometimes just beautiful ideas, that just punchy ideas. And one of them, and I'm going to quote it to you, and I'm going to sort of tell you what I think it's really saying. One of them, it talks about how you make a cheshbon, how you self-evaluate. How do you do that? So it says there that when you do that, you have to know, it says a person has to know his positives, his strength, his ma'alot, his greatnesses, and his deficiencies. You have to know both. Because every person has both, right? And that's a true cheshbon. You have to know both. You have to be able to, when you make a cheshbon, whether it's Elul, or whether it's just generally, you have to pinpoint what did work, what is working, what am I good at, what is, and what am I missing. And I think the power of that strategy removes somewhat the dishonesty of being subjective. Because you know you're going wrong if you can't do this as a first step. Someone who makes a cheshbon and can only come up with his or her weaknesses, or can only come up with his or her strengths, then you know you're doing it all wrong. Then you know you're totally subjective and dishonest. Yeah, does that make sense? You're either just beating yourself up, or you've got no self-awareness whatsoever. If you can be balanced, if you can be honest, or at least perceived a bit to be honest, and you can say, yes, there are things I do well, and this is what it is, things that are working, or things that I've grown in, maybe not perfect, but that I've grown in. And here are the things I think I don't do particularly well, then you're on the right track. Because then it means you are trying to be more honest. You're still biased, you're still subjective, but at least you're having a much more honest look at it. So this first step to marrying these two ideas, because you'll see the people who always criticize themselves, you'll hardly ever hear something good about themselves from them. Right? They'll very quickly tell you that I'm terrible. You know, I'll tell you what all their shortcomings are, but they don't often tell you like what they did right, right? Or never tell themselves what they do right. They just beat themselves up all the time. And beating yourselves up all the time is very ineffective, as we'll soon see. It doesn't bring to anything, right? So strategy one is, can you do both? Can you pinpoint your strengths and your weaknesses? Then you're on the right track. If you can't, if you can only do one or the other, then you know you're just being completely subjective and dishonest with yourself. Every person has strengths. Every person has areas of improvement. Every person has good things. And every person has weaknesses. And you have to be able to pinpoint both. Second thing, of course, is that because at the end of the day, we are subjective. The real way to go through this process, and of course, we have to do it alone. And we have to reflect. And we have to sometimes deeply analyze ourselves. Not every day, all day. That's very ineffective. But at certain designated times, like before Rosh Hashanah, like once a week, or like at night time for the day for a few minutes, whatever the case is. We also have to build into that journey talking to other people. People you can trust. Mentors. Really good friends. Who are close to you. Who care about you. But are not you. Are not objective. They're not subjective. I mean, they're objective, right? I remember in the 80s, the Rebbe launched a campaign. It's not a new campaign. It's written in the Ethics of the Fathers already. But he launched the pushing of the campaign that every person has to have a spiritual mentor. Asei lecha rav, make for yourself a mentor, right? And I remember one particular talk, it was a very telling talk, that the Rebbe asked the question, who does that person have to be? Does it have to be someone who's very knowledgeable? Does it have to be someone that's like a big rabbi somewhere, or like a big person who knows so much more than you? And he said, no, not necessarily. The most important part of a mentor is that he or she is just not you. That's it. Not you. That's the main thing. Obviously, it's got to be a person you can trust and you look up to, obviously. But the main point is that they're not you. That's the main point. And therefore, they love you, they trust you, they can be open with you. That's a real friend or a real mentor. And therefore, they can be objectively honest with you and tell you where you're making a mistake. For good and for bad. Now, what's the test? What's the test if your self-evaluation is good or not? Right? Okay, we'll get to that. Before we do, another important point that's written in a lot of sources of Jewish wisdom. Not only is self-evaluation dishonest and subjective, it's actually worse than that. Sometimes it comes, not always, but sometimes it comes, we'll see how we know in a second. Sometimes it comes actually from a dark side. It comes from a toxic place. What do I mean? It's not just because I'm related. One point is just what we said. We're related to ourselves, we're biased, we're not honest with ourselves. For good and for bad. Another problem is this. God designed us, this is a Jewish foundation, with something we call a Yetzer Tov and a Yetzer Hara. A good inclination and a bad inclination, right? A drive that drives us to do good and a drive that drives us to fail. Okay? There's a great Yiddish expression when they refer to the Yetzer Hara. I think the previous Rebbe used this expression a lot. And he would say that the Yetzer Hara, in Yiddish, you would say, is a klugimker. And klugimker is like a smart aleck. He's like a very, very smart and cunning. What does it mean? The Yetzer Hara knows that sometimes you have a very, very strong conviction about something, right? And you believe in something. So obviously, and you want to do something. I don't know, you do a lot of chesed, you do a lot of kindness for other people, right? The Yetzer Hara is very well aware of this evil inclination, this voice, this inner voice that wants to push us up, set us up to fail, knows very well that it's going to come and tell you, I think you shouldn't do any kindness to anyone anymore, you're not going to listen. Right? There are certain things we all believe in, there are certain things that we're good at, good things that we do, certain mitzvot, whatever the case is, right? There's certain things that people are used to from when they young, right? Just ingrained, they do it. And the Yetzer Hara also sort of like is given up, like he can't change a person. See, it comes with a completely different tactic. And the tactic is to bring the person down. To make the person become a critic of themselves. Like, you never tell a person, don't do this mitzvah. But you will tell a person, the inner voice will come and say, you think your kindness is so good. First, you didn't even do it properly. You think the person really appreciated it, didn't appreciate it. Mm-hmm. You think you were so empathetic. No, your empathy is really lacking, right? Mm-hmm. That's where they get it. To get you down, to get you to criticize yourself. Because false self-criticism doesn't, this is the point, right? Why is it so bad? Because false self-criticism, beating yourself up for no reason, falsely or too much, doesn't bring to improvement. That's the fact. It doesn't bring to growth, right? I have a second cousin my father's first cousin, when he was young, he's much older than me, he was very hard on himself. He was a great student in yeshiva, and he was immersed in his Torah study and his mitzvot and everything. And he would go into the Rebbe and he would write this, like what I described before. He would often sort of criticize himself. And he once wrote a note to the Rebbe. He says he feels that everything he does is for ulterior motives. He says, I'm not really doing it for the right reason. Right? That's, by the way, another great tactic of the Yetzer Hara. You think you're so good, you think you're so holy. Yeah, you're doing it for yourself again. That's it, right? It's a good voice. It's a good persuasion. Once you get to the point, once you believe that, you'll stop doing it eventually. Like, what's the point of doing it if I'm doing it for myself, right? So the Rebbe told me, exactly, he says, don't be convinced by the seemingly authentic self-censure. It's in Yiddish, but that's what he said. He said, because first of all, you can't be believed. Second of all, that's not what the Talmud tells us. The Talmud says, for example, with regard to study of Torah, you should study even if you don't think you're doing it for the 100% the right reason, because deep down you are. Why are you choosing this? In other words, you're choosing this path because it means something to you. Maybe right now you have a couple of ulterior motives, a little bit, but you'll eventually do it for the right reason, right? Do good because it's good. Don't forget why you're doing it so much. I mean, sometimes it matters, obviously. Sometimes agendas can ruin the good we do. But generally speaking, it's a good thing just to do good for the sake of good. There was a story, there was a great Hasidic Rebbe a couple of generations ago called the Tzemach Tzedek. And he had a bunch of followers that were really good. They were on a high level. And one time, a critic came to the Tzemach Tzedek and said, he thinks your followers are so good. He said, they are just gefarbt. Gefarbt in Yiddish means, it's not internal, it's not real, it's just like polish. It's like it's like paint on top of a table. That's what it is. It's superficial. So the Tzemach Tzedek answered this person two things. He said, first of all, even if it is like paint, but they obviously like that color. Right? So it can't be that superficial. I mean, that's the color they chose, right? They could have, if it's superficial, could have chosen a different path, a different color, right? And he said, second of all, when you paint something, eventually it seeps in. It might be it's a color, but it'll seep in. It's not so bad. It's okay, right? So this is the concept, right? So therefore, we have to know sometimes when we self-criticize ourselves for no reason, it's coming from the Klugimker. It's coming from the smart, cunning, toxic voice within us that is trying to set us up to fail. And this is the best strategy. Bring us down. Make us not believe in ourselves. Make us believe that the stuff we're doing is not really authentic or good. And then eventually we'll not be motivated to do it at all. Then we'll give it up. Which really leads us to, this is the point. Again, I said before about marrying these two ideas. Knowing that we are related to ourselves and we self-bias, but at the same time, we have to be self-aware and we have to make the cheshbon. So we've talked about a couple of strategies. One strategy is you've got to be able to know your strengths and your weaknesses. You've got to talk to other people and so on, right? But the main strategy is this. You know the best way to know if it's a good self-evaluation or not? What does it bring to? Very simple. What does it bring to? If it brings you to slow down, if it brings you to become lethargic, if it brings you to be upset with yourself and therefore eventually not grow or even take away the growth that you have achieved, then you know that it was a bad plan. You know that it came from something wrong. But if it actually motivates you, it's not coming from a toxic place, and motivates you to do something to actually grow, like real tshuva, as we talked about before Rosh Hashanah, then you know it's coming from a good place. It's not coming from the Klugimker, it's not coming from the evil inclination. It's coming from a real desire for growth. And growth needs self-awareness, that's true. Right? So all those things together, you have to know your strengths also, but also you need to know where it's coming from. I knew very, very great Hasidic people who were happy. They were the happiest people. I mentioned a few in different stories that I've told you about, right? The one I always mention is Rav Mendel Futterfuss, right, who came out of Russia, and he was the most happiest person. He had such a hard life. And I got to tell you that on the surface, you'd meet him and you hear him talk about himself, he was the biggest self-critic. He like never wanted to have ego, and he always wanted to, he's nothing, and and he was happiest and he kept on growing. Because it didn't come from that. It didn't come from the Yetzer Hara. See, because sometimes it can come from a very good place, just an honest self-awareness. I don't want to overinflate myself. I know my limitations. I know that, you know, compared to God's infinity, I'm just a small speck on the horizon. And yet, I'm full of joy and full of motivation and urgency to grow because I know that this great God, He also knows how deficient I am. And nevertheless, He chose me. And He wants me to serve Him, and He wants me to try, and He knows I'm human, and he, at the giving of the Torah, He actually chose me, me and my friend, another person, to serve Him, and to do a mitzvah, and to do good in the world. And He chose the deficient people. That's what God chose. He chose the struggling race. Could have chosen angels, but He didn't. He chose the struggling race. He chose the weak people. And therefore, I know. And therefore, I'm aware of myself. I know my deficiency. I know my shortcomings. I'm not this big guy, but nevertheless, I'm motivated like everything else. That's where it all depends what it brings to. And that's the best way how to know if it's a good, honest self-evaluation, which for that you need to know also your strengths, also you need to talk to other people, or you know that it's just toxic because it's coming from the Yetzer Hara just to bring you down. Right? Finally, just one final point that we have to be very careful when we criticize ourselves, because the self-criticism, especially when it's false, is actually a violation of one of the Torah principles. How so? We know that the Torah commands us not to talk Lashon Hara. Right? So there's a famous story, evil slander on other people, right? There's a famous story about the great Chofetz Chaim. Chofetz Chaim was a Lithuanian great sage who lived in Radin. He lived before the war. He was called the Chofetz Chaim because he was very renowned. He was a great halachist. He was a great person. But he was also very renowned that he campaigned about not talking evil about other people, right? He wrote books about it. And therefore he got the name Chafetz Chaim, because in Tehillim, King David says, who is the one who wants life? Chafetz Chaim, who wants life? Guard your tongue from speaking evil about other people. So since he was such a campaigner for this principle, he got the name Chafetz Chaim. Okay. Chafetz Chaim was once traveling on a train back to Radin. That's where he lived. And he got into the cabin with someone. And he said, they got into a conversation. He says to the other person, where are you going? So I'm going to Radin. So the Chofetz Chaim says, yeah, I'm also going to Radin. So the Chofetz Chaim says to this person, why are you going to Radin? He says, I'm going to see the Chofetz Chaim. So he says, why are you going to see the Chofetz Chaim? He says, I heard the Chofetz Chaim, such a great person. He's a tzaddik. I'd like to get his blessing. And the Chafetz Chaim says, nah, he's not such a big person. So the guy got so upset that he gave him a slap. Chafetz Chaim didn't say anything. Later, the guy gets to Radin, he rests up. The next day, he goes to see the Chafetz Chaim. Don't forget, no pictures, WhatsApp groups in those days, right? And he walks in, he sees, oh, you face me. I came to Radin to see the Chafetz Chaim, and I end up giving the Chafetz Chaim a patch. And he's so upset. He says, Chafetz Chaim, I'm sorry. I'm devastated. Chafetz Chaim says, calm down. You didn't do anything wrong. In fact, I have to give you a big shkoyach. What's the shkoyach? He says, because, you know, you probably know that I write a lot about speaking Lashon Hara, the laws of Lashon Hara, when you can speak it, when you can't speak it. You taught me a very important halacha that I wasn't aware of. But you're not allowed to speak Lashon Hara on yourself either. And therefore, you've got to be careful. You know, we say you've got to love every Jew. You've got to love your own soul too. Not in an egocentric way. I don't mean you have to overlove yourself. That's not a good thing. But, right? But we have to be kind to ourselves sometimes too. And we have to also not talk Lashon Hara about ourselves. Now, we have to be honest. There's a law with Lashon Hara, with evil speech, that you're allowed to speak it if it's lit to elets, if it's got a purpose, if it'll bring something good. There are times you not only can speak Lashon Hara, but sometimes we are obligated to speak Lashon Hara. To save someone, to protect someone, whatever the case is. Okay, so if it's true self-analysis and we can identify strengths and weaknesses, and we've spoken to mentors and friends, and we know that it's coming from a good place because it's motivating and it's creating a sense of urgency to grow, go ahead. That's good. But if you start talking bad about yourself, it's ineffective, it's bad for you, it brings unhappiness, and it's a violation of Lashon Hara. So you shouldn't do it. Okay, we'll stop there. Continue on next week. Oh, just one, before we go, just a reminder, in 2 weeks' time, tomorrow, is Purim. Please put in your diary, 9:15 in Vaucluse, at Ariella Spiridi's house. We're having our yearly Purim morning tea with the Megillah and everything. No, on the Friday. I have the Thursday also, but the Friday. Friday, 14th of March. I'm sorry?